When I realized I was the liar, in that twinkling of my eye I was changed. Sure was hot in that lake of fire, where my soul got rearranged. Bubbling liquid gold has some precious perfection within. I'm breaking out of the mold through the cracking of my skin.
Welcome to the Gospel Revolution Powercast for the 14th of March 2013, coming to you from the Gospel Revolution Studios in Nashville, Tennessee, where we are linking up once again with the founding president of the Gospel Revolution from GRHQ in beautiful Houston, Texas, Mr. Michael Williams. G'day, Mike.
Good evening, Ferris. How are you today?
I am really good this evening. How are you this morning?
See, you mess it up every time. I'm trying so hard.
You're trying.
and then it's not like you're not trying hard. You're trying hard to mess it up because you love doing it.
It's not like you're trying very hard. You're just plain trying.
Always. Oh, and it's so embarrassing.
No, I love it. It reminds me of home.
Now that truth has come, I never felt like this before. Can't see evil anymore. Now the spirit of life is my law. Is this what I've been waiting for? I hear, welcome to freedom. Welcome to freedom. Well, I would have sworn.
Webcasting to the world.
Do you remember the moment that you saw yourself in God and God in you, and you were one with the universe and God and everybody?
Knowing the truth about the gospel.
You were one with the prostitutes and pimps and priests and kings, and there was nobody on earth that was better than you nor less than you.
That we are all righteous.
And no one on earth was any less in Christ than anyone else.
That's Mike Williams, and this is the Gospel Revolution.
So, Mike, how's the pledge drive going? Help us out here.
Well, my last update from Mr. Robertson down in the offices in Lake Panasoffkee, Florida, was that we are about, we're over a third of the way there. So, and being a third of the way there, a third of the way into the pledge drive is quite all right. It sounds like we're right on schedule, but it is going to take, it's going to take a bit for us to be able to reach our goals. And, we really are wanting to, just to put this in your thinking just a moment, we really are wanting to, send some more funds off to, Kenya. To be able to help there. They are past their elections. We got through it without violence. It's just really been amazing what is happening there in that country. It is maturing. They are in their 50th year since Kenya became a country. And I think nationalism is beginning to take over tribalism. Which is a progress much, much needed in Kenya. And these guys have had to kind of lay low for a while until these elections were passed. But now they're gone, and everybody's ready to get back to work. You got to understand that when elections begin to happen in the past in Kenya, it has been a very violent time. This time it was not. However, they made sure everybody was safe by they suspended public school. No one was going to school. There was a lot of things that were taken as measures and precautions. So the grandchildren there in Kenya, they stayed home.
I don't have any grandchildren. What grandchildren?
I have grandchildren in Africa. Joshua is 7 years old, and Rich Bright, or Richie, as we all call him, is 5 years old. And they are amazing young men.
Their daddy's name wouldn't be Moses, would it?
Yes, Moses and Elizabeth are the parents of these magnificent young men, and I'm looking forward to being able to be a part of their lives, even though at a distance, as they grow up and become happy, healthy young gentlemen, and I think they're going to touch the world.
Wow. You were saying something about the pledge drive when the boys' names came up.
Yes. One of the things that I'm really hoping that we can raise enough funds for is to meet the needs that we have here, but also to be able to send some funds over to Kenya. I shave off as much as I possibly can, sometimes more than I should, maybe, but not just from the ministry, but from my personal finances also. But recently, we have not been able to do very much due to some extra expenses that we've incurred. But what Moses and Elizabeth accomplished there for the gospel is just way too valuable. Elizabeth is getting ready to open her own business, and we'll be telling you actually more about that a little bit in the future. And Moses has his own school there, and the school is growing back slowly. They're having to get past the elections, so now things can get back to normal and they can get back to advertising and getting things going, because elections have not gone well in Kenya in past years in their 50-year history. However, this one did go well, and there was no violence, contrary to the prophets' foreboding forecast of much violence and bloodshed. It did not come to fruition.
Oh, poor prophet.
Poor prophet.
Moses tells me this is the prophet that goes and gets his advice from a snake in the cave somewhere. No, seriously. I'm not kidding you.
I know. It doesn't make any difference whether it's a snake in a cave or a salamander in Utah or what, you know, it's just it's just so ridiculous. Whether you got it in a dream or, prophecy has been fulfilled. And the fulfilled nature of the gospel on every level is just so vitally important for this planet to know. If we could even comprehend the things that the fulfilled nature of the gospel reveals to us, and if you were to go through our cultures around the planet and see what that would eliminate from this planet, it would be the vast majority of all of the really horrible stuff if we understood the fulfilled nature of the gospel. Unfulfilled prophecies and prophecies yet to be known, they're destroying people's lives around the planet as we speak. So it's vitally important that we get this message out. There are people losing their lives out of desperation for knowing and understanding the fulfilled nature of the gospel.
So the pledge drive, bring us up to date with that. What's happening with the pledge drive, mate? We're getting rich yet?
Jeff is, his dialing finger is being worn to the bone. And he's just relentless. I don't know where he gets the fortitude to do what he does when pledge drive comes around.
I think he's slacking it. I just don't think the guy's working hard enough, frankly. I mean, what's he do between like 10 p.m. and 10 a.m.? That's what I want to know. What does he do when the rest of us are sleeping? See, you don't know, do you? You haven't checked up on this?
And I'm not going to ask either. I'm afraid of what the answer might be. So,
okay. So you were saying we're getting rich quick.
Well, right now, my last update from Jeff, we're just concluding the first week of the pledge drive, and we are a third of the way there. So, hey, if this continues, we will be successful in this pledge drive also. I think every pledge drive has been successful. I think there's one time that we missed our goals. And everything turned out well. Anyway, it seemed as though that soon after that we had funds come in from somewhere that was a bit unexpected. But this is an important pledge drive. We really are doing our best to reach as far and wide as we can with as much as we have. And we are only limited by the funds that come in.
How did Eva go, mate? How did Eva go with the 25,000 missionaries?
You know, she has called me, and I actually, that was yesterday, and I have not been able to sit down and call her back. I'm looking so much forward to finding out exactly what happened. But, yeah, so, you know, here we have all these things going. They're really, really wonderful. And we don't pay Eva. I don't want anybody to feel misled in by the fact that we bring up some of these things, that we are funding what Eva is doing. Eva's doing this all on her own. These are just reports of all the things that the Gospel Revolution are doing.
But without that CD that was sitting in Richard Mull's car radio CD player after his death, that was put out by the effect of people's pledges and by what makes it possible for you to get out this gospel of grace and peace, Eva wouldn't be doing what she's doing today, would she?
No, and the fact of it is that was a CD in the car of a man who was one of the greatest supporters of the Gospel Revolution.
Now, if we don't meet our quota with this pledge drive, we're going to have to shut some services down, as I understand it. For example, the prayer cloths, they're going to be gone. I think, didn't you say something about the fact that we won't be able to respond with effective, fervent prayer as much as we would, you know, because we'd have to be out earning some money?
Well, the biggest thing is our color-coded garments that indicate what status we have.
What?
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, those? Oh, yes, the garments, yes.
Yes, of course. You know, I think I'd kind of be the Pope of the Gospel Revolution, right? Nobody elected me, though.
Il Papa and, Michael.
Yeah, you know, Jeff has to wear a certain color to represent his status.
Isn't it green for getting money or something, isn't it?
Well, I think it's green for Irish in his case. So this is Jeff's month, too. Oh, my gosh.
Hey, have you seen his name on Skype? You seen what he calls himself on Skype? Zero expectations. Are you sure we got the right guy picking up the cash, mate? Are you sure about this?
I know. He's on the phone with zero expectations. No, that is Jeff's approach to this and other things in life to save himself disappointment. So,
blessed are they who do not expect much, or they shall not be disappointed.
That's right.
You know, a pastor once told me that God gives you sheep as a pastor. God gives you sheep so that you can shear them. I've got no idea why he didn't just say fleece them and be done with it. We tend to think that that three-ring circus that televangelists go on with, and there's not one out there that really, I mean, there is a few that are superb. Mike Murdoch. Have you seen Mike Murdoch recently? I mean, that man, he lowers his voice and speaks softly and brings it right home to you, and then invites you to send your one-time-only $1,000 seed offering. But he's not alone. There's a ton of them out there, from Benny Hinn to Kenneth Copeland, all the way down the line. The whole deal is, if you sow money in, you'll get money back. It's like a tree. You plant the seed, and you'll get the whole thing back in the fruit. This started way back, and it's been going from the beginning. It's really what Jesus railed about with the religious leaders of his day. And here is a little monk. Now, what was this monk's name? We used to, oh yeah, of course, this was Friar Johann Tetzer. from Germany, and this little German monk said this in his day.
Wenn das Geld im Kasten klingt, die Seele in den Himmel springt.
This good old boy knew a thing or two about how people work. Rough translation goes, when the coin in the box does thump, then the soul into heaven does jump. The whole concept of indulgences, this was called. You outlay a shekel or three, and into heaven you go. Nice and easy. They've never, ever once repudiated the concept of indulgences. Makes you really think, doesn't it? This has been going on for years, but you're not going to find it here simply because we have nothing to promise you. The only thing we can promise you is peace of mind with the gospel of grace and peace, and we can't promise you anything past that because what is worth more than that? Anyway, you won't be hearing that here. The bottom line simply is this. We are honored that people like you want to partner with people like us to get the gospel of grace and peace out to the world. I was talking with Jeff just the other day, and we were discussing the postage costs that we have here at the Gospel Revolution, and I was astounded. We're talking in the thousands and thousands of dollars for postage costs. A lot of our people aren't on the internet, can't get a newsletter or by email, and we're locked into those costs to keep our people in touch with what's happening in the Gospel Revolution. You are making it possible for us to continue this. With all our hearts, thank you. If the Bible is all about Jesus, don't you think that most churches would mention him with at least the same frequency as they mention all of their favorite dogmas and doctrine and all those rules of your particular brand of religion? Tithing, moralism, Old Testament law, abortion, gays, politics, all hail the leader, persecution, the end times, don't forget the bloody rules, God's perfect will for your life, fleeing youthful lusts, rock music, speaking in tongues, the coming kingdom, worldliness and how to escape it, those pesky rules, don't forget them, heresy, prophecy, soul-winning missions, offerings, wrong doctrine, right doctrine, and don't forget all those bloody rules, relationships, long hair, short hair, dyed hair, liberalism, greasy grace, Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve, dispensationalism, and rules, rules, never ending bloody rules, and Calvinism, Arminianism, a missionary service, Sunday school, swearing and cussing, besetting sin, sexual purity, oh, and give us some more rules, won't you? False prophets, confession, dress code, mixed swimming, dancing, movies, television, dating, oh, and did I mention the freaking rules? So, Michael, today I think if I recall the teaser we gave folks last week, we're dealing with how does this living without guilt and shame in their life, how does it translate into daily living?
Well, when you are absent of guilt and shame, of course, you are free from any expectations of punishment or reward.
Zero expectations?
Yeah, kind of like Jeff's handle that he has there. So I sat here and watched a video the other day about the something of one. And of course, it being anything, the one of one or the oneness of one or whatever it was, I, of course, am going to watch it because it's got the title of my book in it. So and it was a whole range of mystics from around the world in all religions. And it was really amazing because they were saying that we are one. Now, they were all saying that we are one, but they had this experience of oneness. There was, you know, they were driving down the road. They were taxi drivers. They were distraught. They were this, they were that, whatever, you know. And suddenly from inside of them come this incredible awareness that we are all one. We're one with God. We're one with each other. It is such a powerful understanding of oneness. I think they feel one with the flowers and the trees and birds and everything.
But as I listened to them, and they interviewed at least seven of these guys, but the thing that I noticed was this struggle to maintain this awareness. The one thing they all agreed on is that there are no words to explain this. And I'm sitting there and I'm saying, oh, but there are words to explain this. There are words to explain this. The gospel explains oneness. It details what has been eliminated to allow the oneness. So Barris, they've truly gotten a revelation of oneness. And it lines up totally with what we've taught about the gospel, that all of this information is in the heart from birth. As they described their experience, they depend heavily and only on that experience to validate what they think is truth.
What experience?
That experience at whatever point that they finally saw it. And they say that their heart, they just, from in their heart, they saw this oneness, and they were one with, it sounds like me, they were one with God, and they were one with the universe, and one with each other, and nobody on earth was less than anybody else. So they said all of that. I also saw in this brief interview, and we're going to go into a great deal of detail on this at some point, I saw each of them struggling almost desperately to maintain the experience, because outside the experience, there is no understanding of oneness. There's chanting, there's involvement on a daily basis. One of them made this comment. She said, you're going to get as much out of this as you put into it. And it was almost like a Christian definition. And most of their application of this is very Christian, actually. And she said, you need to put in at least 2 hours in the morning of meditation and, you know, the little rituals and things that they go through.
Your quiet time.
Yes, your quiet time. And if you put that into it, then you will get this out of it, this feeling of oneness, this feeling of serenity, and you begin to change. See, I believe them 100%. They were talking about how people would come and say, teach me how to have this experience. And they'd say, we can't teach you. And once we got across to them that there was no way to tell them how to have this, that was the beginning of their journey. And then they would show these pictures of people from around the world doing their bowing and wearing their particular little garbs and robes and different things, trying. My heart went out to them, to tell you the truth, because I'm trying to think, what would life be like had I gotten this revelation of the gospel in my heart and never had words to match it? I don't know what I would do, Barris. But to say there are no words that describe this oneness. Now, see, I don't have to have quiet time in the morning. I don't have to have a scripture time, a reading time, a prayer time, a praying in tongues time, or a chanting time. I don't have to wear a particular garb or a particular color. However, my orange shirt looks really good on me today. Don't you think?
Sufi Michael.
Orange Sufi. Oh, is it souffle?
You're a dessert fella.
So this has captured my imagination, that we have such wonderful people with this serenity, but it seems as though by reenacting the moment of enlightenment is what's happening every day. They reenact it to try to stay in contact with it. Now,
they're trying to recapture an aha moment, a moment we might call a moment of revelation. But they're trying to recapture the essence of the emotions that went along with that, yes?
Oh, absolutely. That keeps the calmness and the calmness of mind, which, see, I understand that coming from the heart to the mind. But to say there's nothing of knowledge that can come to the mind that will match that up, my heart went out to these people because I have that serenity. Now, these guys were all sharing their experience, so I will share mine. I feel zero shame. They believe that all of their actions and deeds have some
reaction in the universe and in their lives. And this is a spiritual reaction that takes place. In the gospel, I know and understand that my actions and deeds have zero spiritual consequences or benefits. That is when we get to this point of being freed from guilt and shame. I have said for years, it's in everybody's heart from birth, and to hear people who've had this birthed right out of their heart without anybody telling them anything was so exciting to me. And I'd kind of known this for years, but I've never sat and just listened to it altogether. But they have to isolate their lives from everything to try to maintain this. And they talk about the serenity and the peace of mind. But it's not serenity and peace of mind and freedom from guilt and from shame if you have to stop doing what being human is on a daily basis to maintain that. I don't have to go to a faraway place and wear a far out garb and maintain.
Mike, I hate to tell you, I might have to be the one to break this to you. You've already done it.
I'm already far out, huh?
Well, you're wearing that thing.
That my orange shirt.
Yeah, and you told me you're going to get a shirt from Moses' wife, and I know that's going to be even more thingy. And you're living way down there in thingy.
Yeah, away from everyone.
Away from everyone.
Yeah.
Seems to me they missed you on this show.
Yes, they did.
Think quickly, mate.
I'm not good at thinking quickly. I think slowly.
Mike, now here's what you said in your email to me a couple of weeks ago. Attaching positive or negative outcomes to daily events as spiritual, and I'm going to rephrase that, associating positive or negative outcomes to daily events as being spiritual marks the end of spiritual growth and the continuation of self-righteousness filled with its little associates, guilt and pride.
Yes. And here's the shocking thing that I found in watching the interview with these mystics. That is, they attach spiritual application to all of the actions of daily life. We've just been talking about this, Barris, and then I go and I watch this video and I realize, my gosh, there's something here we need to hear from these people. You had me listen to Brené. It is wonderful. But now she comes from an education point of this. She is highly educated. But still, again, it was amazing to me to hear her tell her story. But then she went into a three-day seclusion of this feeling that she had failed and all of this and how she had to struggle with that. Now, like I said, these people are sharing their experience, and I guess I can share mine. I don't struggle with that stuff at all. I may not be nearly as enlightened.
Maybe you're just not serious, Michael.
I know I'm not nearly as educated as Brené. Oh, my gosh. Brené came from a highly educated view of this. But still, because she said something that she was not sure she should have said, she went through 3 days of remorse about it. To where that she could even come out of her bedroom 3 days later. And then the mystics who don't get any of it from knowledge at all. It's not an education at all. It is an experience. This is what I'm learning now. I may be saying some of this wrong. So if I don't mind somebody taking me to task over it, but please understand this is how I learn. I speak my foolishness out of my mouth. So on both sides, from the extremely educated view to the holy and completely revealed view, absent the gospel, there is still this struggle to maintain and gain something. Now, I seem to be absent of this struggle that I see them still having. I see many people in the gospel revolution being absent of this struggle that I see out there. I am thrilled that there is somebody, anybody out there saying we are one, that God and man are one and we are all one together. That's my whole wheelhouse. So I don't care from what point they say it. The fact that they got it really is validation that what I've said about the gospel all these years is really true, that we are born righteous, we are born holy, and we are born with this imprinted in the heart. And this is the new heart that we have been given, and now we've got to have the mind renewed to this. I didn't attempt to get rid of my guilt. I didn't try to get rid of shame. I made no attempts to try to do this. Our show today is following up on our issues of guilt and shame, and attaching, especially the guilt and the shame that is attached to daily life. We went quite a bit in detail about the renewing of the mind and how the mind is affected by this, of course. The ability to see the work of the cross as being the thing that was predestined, predetermined, all of these things, it's so vitally important. Paul makes the argument that the purpose of God was purposed in the body of Christ. So if God had a purpose, the purpose was going to be done in the body of Christ. God has no purpose for your life. You see, freedom is either freedom or it's not. You can't be free and controlled by someone else at the same time. You're either free or you're not free. For me, that is a very powerful place. The power of that freedom then causes us to be able to deal with life in a very rational way. I so believe that the human is designed to endure and recover from all of life's events. It doesn't make any difference how fracturing. We are designed to recover from everything, mentally and emotionally. We are designed to recover. And it is many times in that recovery that we find ourselves. We find ourselves on the other side of tragedy and loss. Loss that can be unspeakable. I've had my losses. You've had yours. Everybody on this planet has. If you've breathed for very long, you've experienced loss. Now, when you attach some spiritual value to that loss.
Now, by that, what you mean is something bad has happened to me. Therefore, I must have done something wrong.
Yes.
Okay.
Let me set up a scenario. So a man cheats on his wife, and he finds out later that his child has cancer. Now, I do not have to tell you that people create a spiritual connection between the adultery and the cancer. My God, if I hadn't done this, this would not have happened. No, you see, there is no logical connection between adultery in one person's life and cancer in another person's life.
Now, there is a historical connection in so much as I'm going to lay some curses out in front of you. I'm going to lay some blessings out in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to lay life. I'm going to lay death. Choose this day life so that everything can go well with you. There is this historical, biblical connection.
Yes, there is a scriptural connection. And the reason that this cause and effect was set up, Barris, was so that we could understand the cross. When we fail to accept that that was in place, we do not understand the cross. These things were predestined, and all of that scripture has been fulfilled. Here is, again, with the mystics, these wonderful people that I sat and watched who believe that the world is one. They do not have that connection of what was predestined that led to this absolute oneness. They don't have that because the brain is going to think that way until the brain has a story that resolves all of this. The same thing is true about natural disasters. There was a connection between natural disasters and sin, between droughts and floods and all of these things. Read it in the scriptures. It was there. I don't deny that at all. But see, the thing that people that understand the gospel have, this is the gain. This is the edge, if you will, that we have. This personal experience of gaining this knowledge and this understanding has removed the connection between what I do, right or wrong, and a hurricane.
if the gospel is true at all, these things are no longer connected. No longer will a child die because their father committed adultery. No longer will a nation be judged because it has gone wrong in the eyes of God. And it is this ability that the gospel has to invade the brain and rewire it away from all of those things to where that I do not take any spiritual implications from the situations that happen in my life. Now, when I watched all of these guys, that is the part I saw they don't get. This is something that is absent there, and my heart goes out to them. I desperately want to learn from them because they have insights and they have a way of articulating it that I think is wonderful. Any one of them have things to say about oneness that would enhance what I have to say many times over. So these are not people that I oppose. My life was consumed with, let me tell you, this is how bad this was. And for the sake of just communicating this accurately, I'm just going to tell the story the way it is. I usually try to keep certain things out of our conversation to make it palatable for other people. But I'm going to tell the story just as it is because I know there will be many people that will connect. I was 14 years old. I was sexually aware. I am terrified of my sexuality. Masturbation is a part of my life as a 14-year-old, and it is totally forbidden, which made it absolutely irresistible even more. I was taught that masturbation was an absolute sin. I was taught also of all of the things that happen because of sin. I'm a freshman in high school, and I come home one day, and there's an ambulance parked out front of our house. The ambulance driver had come by himself. I walk in the bedroom, and my mother doesn't know me. She's delirious. I have to help the ambulance driver carry my mother out the front door and down the steps and load her into the ambulance. And off she went. And then my mother is diagnosed with cancer. And that was October. And by December the 28th, she was dead. I remember standing outside her hospital room, and she had had a massive cerebral hemorrhage that was brought on by the leukemia that she had, and stood outside of her room and listened to her take her last breaths. And when they came out and told us that my mother was dead, I was a 14-year-old boy, the youngest of six children, standing outside my mother's hospital room, and I knew I had caused her death. I was responsible for my mother's death. I couldn't stop sinning. I couldn't stop masturbating even to save my mother's life. I passed out. Now, nobody ever knew this, but when I try to explain to people that by the age of 15, I went into the mental institution the first time, and that led me from there to six terms in mental institutions and lockup wards, three attempts of suicide. Now, people wonder why this is a passion for me. Why does Mike Williams, why is he so adamant about trying to help people disconnect this cause and effect religion? Because I know the pain and the suffering of it as much as someone could take it on to themselves. I was on the phone the other day with one of my very dear friends. They lost one daughter several years ago to cancer, and they now have a second daughter that has cancer. During their first daughter's death, they were heavily entrenched in the Word of Faith movement and would not make a negative confession. The pastor of their church went to them and asked them to leave the church after the funeral. He asked them to leave the church because he did not want their lack of faith to infect the rest of the church. So I have watched the cruelty of this connection between spirituality and daily events over and over and over. And I know if I had not had this spell broken off of me through the power of the gospel, I would be insane or dead by now. One of the two.
When you're feeling down or you got the case of the blues, why don't you listen to the
Gospel Revolution?
Listen in your All around the world, more and more people have stopped going to church. In the United States alone, almost 3 million walk out of church every year and never go back. Could it be the conflicting message of a loving God that will torture many in a place called hell was just a little too much? Could it be that the gospel is good news for everyone, the whole world, and not just good news for few and bad news for most? Could it be that there is no division of people, some sinners, some saints? The number one reason people gave for leaving church was they did not believe their pastors were telling them the gospel truth. And they were right. If the gospel truth is not good news for everyone, it's not good news for anyone. 1. The Gospel According to Mike by Mike Williams. Available at bookstores, Amazon.com, and other fine retailers.
1 is now available as an ebook at Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com for a limited time only at the introductory price of just $3.99. Available also in hardback and paperback.
Gospel Revolution.
This week, Michael, we received a letter from Barb, and she writes, "When I heard Beres on the radio the other night mention Brené Brown, I decided to write this letter. I had listened to Mike for almost a year and still couldn't see what he was saying. It wasn't, hey, Mike, that's a good thing, mate, you can keep them online for a year, and even if they don't get word you're saying, they still..."
They keep listening.
Oh, thank heavens. "It wasn't until I listened to Brené that I understood what it was that was stopping me from seeing. I finally recognized the loudest voice in me countering everything Mike said. It was shame. Religion was like the drug or the fix to shame that kept me going back to legalism to fight shame." That's an interesting statement, isn't it? "Religion was like the drug or fix to shame that kept me going back to legalism to fight shame." Wow.
Yeah, Beres, that is such a monumental statement to make. And this is how we learn. You know, we say what we can say, but it really is by hearing back from people that we continue our own education and understanding. And this is very true. This is this addiction to religion that creates the shame, offering the answer for the shame. Now, that is like the Stockholm syndrome. And the Stockholm syndrome is a syndrome that was identified many years ago, where that a person begins to become endeared to their captors because the person that's abusing you is also handing you your food. So there is this really crazy addiction that can happen in these situations. And where Christianity is concerned, it is an addiction, because if there's anything that is responsible in the Christian's life for the shame in their life, it's Christianity. It's the one that has brought this dastardly problem in. They feed you the shame and then stand with the other hand out saying, "Here is the remedy for the shame." And I understand her comment. It really is a very powerful thing to say, that she could not hear what I had to say for a year because of this battle going on between the shame and the relief from the shame. Then if you listen to me, then you have to let go of what on a religious cycle is relieving you from your shame. It is very difficult to let go of a religious cycle. Now, we go through this all the time. People who say that for a period of time after they receive the gospel, they feel lost because there's not these old things to go back to. And it really is learning to live free.
She goes on to say here, Michael, "The promises of perfectionism by legalism for my freedom held me prisoner. The promises of perfectionism by legalism for my freedom held me prisoner. The shameful things I didn't like about me or hated about me held its hope in being perfect." So this carrot on the stick was the hope of being perfect was being held out in front of Barb. She says, "Perfection is what shame demands or tries to attain, and religion promises it in a disguise named if." I'm going to guess that she's saying, yeah, if you do this, God will do that.
Yeah.
This is when the wedding, this is a gorgeous picture here, mate. This is when the wedding of shame and religion is consummated with the promise of becoming perfect. And the outcome, I guess the love child of it, was hopelessness for me.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, and Barris, that is the thing. I mean, how are you going to get away from the struggle for perfection when the scriptures themselves require perfection? If you go back and study the scriptures, especially the law, Deuteronomy, if you look at it about the law, it's very clear that not only you must keep all the law to be blessed. It requires perfection for this blessing. For a good outcome, you must keep all of the law all the time. For a bad outcome, you only need to break one law once. The mystics will tell you that the goal is not perfection. And that is true. But the vitally important thing that we need to say here is the goal was perfection, but the goal is no longer perfection because perfection was attained for the entire human race in Christ. Perfection has been attained, and perfection in our daily life is no longer a goal.
Barb goes on to say, I have always thought that if Mike and Brené's books were read together, you could free many religious addicts out there. I even sent an email to Brené to tell her that her book freed me from being a religious addict. Religion kept me going back for more legalism to try to be set free. This is, and then she says, this is something I wrote back then when reading from the 6 definitions of an ism. It also helped me understand why perfectionism and religion were so powerful together. What is an ism? It is a doctrine, a system of principles or practices that indicate behavior or characteristics or quality that indicate a state or condition that is language, a state or condition, the language of which characteristically indicates an action or process that results in prejudice on the basis of that ism. That's a pretty deep statement right there, so I'm going to repeat it. It is a doctrine, system, or principle / practices that indicate behavior or characteristics that indicate a state or condition, the language of which characteristically indicates an action or process, we are moving towards perfection, that results in prejudice on the basis of that ism. Number one, indicating an action, process, or result, a la criticism or terrorism, indicating a state or condition, paganism, indicating a doctrine, system, or body of principles and practices, spiritualism or Leninism, indicating behavior or a characteristic quality, heroism, indicating a characteristic usage, especially of a language, Americanism or colloquialism, or indicating prejudice on the basis specified, sexism or ageism. This was what I wrote in my early moments of identifying shame. The noise inside me. Finding out what it is, what drives it, and how it manifests. The noise is really shame, hiding behind perfectionism. Empowered by self-righteousness that can be identified by judgment, which in return is a mainly powerless attempt to silence the shame. Wow.
Powerful.
She continues, the vicious circle continues because perfectionism is a bottomless pit fueled by fear, built on false hope of performance, and ultimately it relies upon you. The religious dogmas handed out to shame-based people gives a hopeless hope and leaves us desperate. This is because it reminds you of the alcoholic who, you know, 1,000 drinks is not enough and one's too many. You can never quench that thirst. This is because you're trying to make a do-based love that doesn't exist and that depends on you. What needs to happen is to replace it with a who-based love. Who you are in Christ is a new creation. This is where the gospel began to make sense and overcome my shame.
Now, freedom. When life and everything that happens to you is no longer the results of your or my actions, my guilt, my fear, my shame, my punishments or my rewards, life or situations in life can become the greatest teacher and healer of the soul. That's what you say, Mike, when you talk about the observer.
Yeah.
Now when something happens, Barb says, it isn't about God punishing or the devil getting a foothold for things that were undone or things that were done. Life is a teacher and a healer. Jesus came to bring us life. He is the lover of our soul. Live life, don't fear it. Perfect love casts out fear and punishment and guilt and shame. Sure, there are consequences, but not eternal torment. Thanks to all of you who share. Thanks for reading this. Thanks for being the examples. You are. Love you all. Thank you, Mike, for giving your heart to all. Barb. And then she adds a PS. Brené's book, The Gift of Imperfection, is a big part of my ability to grab hold of the gospel of peace and the gospel of grace. Shame was a stumbling block I needed to overcome, and her book exposed that for me. I love this, Michael. I just love it because truth is where you find it.
Oh, absolutely.
She was a little bit of the puzzle that I'm grateful for. Without it, I couldn't see the beautiful portrait Mike so clearly knew. I understand the power when the preacher gives the call, come and die. How that operates in the hearts of those who believe wholeheartedly. I also know why I failed at dying to self. Funny thing is, trying to die to self almost killed me. Almost. Barb.
Yeah, and Bob, thank you so much. I would like to just send you a big old hug and congratulate you and so thankful for what has happened. We're grateful that in what we were attempting to communicate with you for a year, that Brené's teachings unlocked it all for you. I think that is absolutely wonderful. Let me tell you, my goal is to see people free. I don't care if it takes none of me, some of me and a little of something else, or some of me and something of 10 other things. It doesn't make any difference to me. We intend to tap into every possible thing from every possible person that is going to help bring understanding. And that's the reason I'm telling you that we're going to tap into this whole arena of the mystics, because they have things to say. There is something very powerful about people from around this planet in every religion have had this heart revelation of absolute oneness, contrary to all of their religious training. And Brené, if there's any way that you should ever be listening to this, we thank you so much for your work and what you do to help bring peace to other people's lives. We think you're awesome here at the Gospel Revolution. And we do recommend that you pick up Brené's material. Please go to TED.com and type in Brené's name. You get these things absolutely free, and they're short. I don't think she does anything more than 20 minutes long that I've seen so far, and it's very impactful. This letter really is a demonstration of the need for the gospel, not just to latch into an experience, but to literally have the words that will reconstruct the way we think. You don't have to battle with the way we used to think the rest of your life. There are words that explain this divine truth of oneness. And those words are the very great clarity of the gospel of peace and the gospel of grace.
I think, Barb, by sending that letter, you just you put everything we wanted to say today clearer, more concise, and more perfectly, certainly than I could have, and probably than we could have done in 2 hours on this show. Thank you, Barb. I remember for me, this wasn't one of the big ahas for me or revelation moments, but it was an absolute in a long life of questions. I attended a course that went by the name of Landmark Education.
Mm-hmm. I'm familiar with it.
You know this one?
I am familiar with Landmark.
I'll have to get you to tell me why later. And as I sat there, I went through. We went through a very intense week-long course, and it was from. It seemed at the time from sunup to sundown, but it wasn't really. It was just a very thorough course in understanding ourselves. And at the very last night, the graduation night, if you like, there was this demonstration made on stage. They would lift up a painted chocolate ice cream and a painted vanilla ice cream. They'd have somebody come up to the person, and he'd hold these two ice creams out, and he would say, choose. And they'd pick one. And the person would say, who had the ice creams would say, why did you pick that one? Oh, some people would say, because I really like vanilla, the taste of vanilla, and da-da-da-da-da. Wrong. They had to go through it again. Choose. Took chocolate this time. Why did you do chocolate? Oh, because I like chocolate, and chocolate's nice. And wrong. And it didn't matter what the people said. Whatever they said, it was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Until they actually got, I chose because I chose.
Yes.
I am taking the personal responsibility to say, that was a choice of mine. I made that choice. I wanted to make that choice. I don't have to explain it. I chose because I chose.
Yeah, it's called justification.
And I don't have to choose. I don't have to justify my choices anymore. I still had to for a long time because I couldn't get free of what religion had done to me. But if I choose to do something now, Michael, I just choose to do it.
Thus the absence of guilt.
Now, I want to know how you know Landmark Education.
Well, I sent my daughter there, actually. Audrey, I sent her there in 2005. It had been within a year after all of this about the family had come to light, and I was desperate to find help for my little girl. And she came back. I kind of thought she'd been to a cult because, I mean, she went from this one arena into everything's a possibility, you know. And she was absolutely obnoxious. It was.
Oh, dear.
But her response, she came and sat down at my feet. I was in a big chair like this, and my little girl was sitting at my feet, looking up at me in a way that she had not done since she was 8 years old before this whole molestation thing started with her in her life. And she's looking up at me, eye contact and everything, which had not happened in so many years. And I was trying to get her to tell me, what is it that's different? I hear what you're saying, but you're not telling me why everything is different for you. Tell me why this is different. And she thought a minute and she said, I went into this weekend being a molested child. I came out of this weekend being a child that was molested.
Wow.
So her shame was in her identity, and she identified herself as a molested child instead of being a child that was molested, which is all really powerful stuff, actually, with what we're even talking about. Bear says a huge difference between being a molested child and a child that was molested. It sounds like just terminology, but it's not. It's a vast, vast difference. So anyway, that was my personal connection to Landmark. There's another connection with Landmark, and that is one of the guys who used to work for me, Michael Blanch, who was just here at my house visiting recently. And several years before Audrey went to this, I found out he had gone. And she came home saying, you know, we are human beings, not human doings. That's one of my statements that I'd come up with. I said, well, I guess anybody could see the difference in that, but I had made this statement some 15 years before that we are human beings, not human doings. It was one of my little catchphrases for identity and being free from the law.
So then I'm talking to Michael, and back in the early years of Landmark is when Michael had gone through this earlier years, where that the actual founder was the one who was taking people through the courses. And when Michael got up, you know, and they do the graduation thing and everything, and they asked them, you know, kind of what did you get out of this? What would you like to say? And Michael said, during this week, I became a human being and I stopped being a human doing. And he was quoting me. And so the leader of the group heard this, and it became a part of the entire curriculum for Landmark, was that they are human beings and not human doings.
Now, family, we're not saying that you need to go to Landmark, and we're not saying you have to read Brené Brown's books. We're not saying you have to do this with Deepak Chopra or listen to Mike Williams. What we're saying is there comes a point sometimes where it seems to me like the eternal reaches out and strokes my mind. And it only strokes it because my mind can't take anymore. And there is an aha moment that happens where the love child that's born of this is a realization that I am part of one. That I am. Winston Churchill is attributed with having said, "Men occasionally stumble over the truth, but most of them pick themselves up and hurry off as if nothing ever happened." Don't do that with this. Like Mike said in the introduction to the show tonight. How did that go again, Mike?
I don't know. What did I say?
When you realize you're one with the pimps and the priests and the prophets and the...
Oh, yes.
Say that again for us, William, mate, because I can't find it on the tape that it came off. I've been looking for it, and I want to find it. So just go and do it.
Don't know what it says. I've heard it 1,000 times, and I can't do it.
But sometime that will impact you. And I'm speaking now to Christians. I'm speaking to religionists. I'm speaking to people who feel that they really can't trust themselves to something that is this different. I want to say this to you. You know that you have never really felt free. If you did, you know that you would not have to hide some of the things you hoped were true, you wished were true, or that even might be true, for fear of being rejected by the tribal mentality. But I want to tell you, this is true. It just simply is true. To be free from guilt, to be free from shame in my daily living, in my being able to make decisions and not feel like I have changed somebody else's eternal outcomes or my own temporal outcomes because of what I've chosen. I might do stupid things, but never again will I ever sin.
Absolutely. And, you know, Barris, when I was a kid, there was a cartoon called Ferdinand the Bull. So, of course, Ferdinand the Bull is the, you know, he's out there to defeat the matadors, and he's a big brawny bull, big black bull. But Ferdinand had an enlightenment, I guess you would say, when he smelled a flower one day. And Ferdinand was constantly wanting to get away from the arena and not really be a bull anymore. His whole job in life, he thought, was to smell the flower. So they would get ready for the big event, and where's Ferdinand the Bull? And the cheering and everything would be going on, but they would find Ferdinand up on a hillside. He had found a flower, and Ferdinand was sitting on his haunches, sitting there with this flower in between his front legs, and he would bend down and he would and he would sniff again and again. And so Ferdinand the Bull actually became fairly useless because he was trying to duplicate his experience over and over again. These moments of enlightenment where that suddenly great clarity, and I call it clarity. I know that the mystic community calls it enlightenment. You just get clarity and suddenly you understand everything without understanding anything, and it's okay. Well, I kind of think that you might become something like Ferdinand the Bull if you had this all the time. And you could sit and smell the flower all day long. And
Never have anyone disturb you out of that wonderful, blissful moment of clarity. Do you remember the Apollo 13 movie with Tom Hanks? Do you remember how that on their way back, that, of course, they had lost all power in the lunar module, and it had no power. The limb was still connected, and the only thing that had power was the limb. And as they had looped around the natural orbit of the moon and were coming back, the possibility of these guys making it back in a vehicle that had no power was just crazy to even think that they were going to make it back. So what they would do is occasionally they would NASA would ask them, what do you see out the window? Well, we see this and that. Well, you're supposed to see the Earth. If you're seeing the Earth out your window, then you're on the right trajectory. Well, we don't see it. What do we need to do? Well, we're going to fire up the limb, the power on the limb, and we're going to point this in a certain direction to where that we're going to burn long enough to where that suddenly you are able to see the Earth again, and then shut down that burn. And, you know, they go through this in the movie. It's really well done. And they suddenly it's a tin can being tossed about in outer space. And one's looking out the window, the other's doing the burn, one's telling the other one what to do, and suddenly he says, there it is, and they shut down the burn. And what this one burn has done is changed their trajectory forever. I guess this is the way this is for me, Barris. I don't want to become Ferdinand the Bull. I don't want to sit and sniff flowers all day. I want to live my life. I don't think we need to live in those moments. These moments are like firing up the limb and giving us a trajectory change so that we can see where we're going. Really, isn't that what it's all about, is being able to see where you're going? And once it's clear, it's like, oh, okay, I can see where I'm going. Jesus said that a person that's in darkness don't know where they're going. You can't even see where you're going. But these moments, these aha moments, these moments of clarity, enlightenment, please don't think that you have to have this going on in your life all the time. These are trajectory changes. These things will change the way you think forever. In the moments of clarity that I have in the journey of my life, while I'm having it, I am useless. I'm totally useless. Now I want you to stop and think about it. How useful were you in a moment of clarity? Nothing I say makes sense to anybody else. Nothing. There's no need in me trying to communicate it, because it's for me. It is my moment. And the moment I start trying to explain it all, everybody else thinks I've lost my mind. But once I come out of that and I'm kind of no longer Ferdinand the Bull sitting there sniffing the flower, and I'm kind of back at what life takes, I can explain what this was all about. Now I can explain how I think differently than I did before that moment of clarity or before that enlightenment. But you see, to struggle to stay in the enlightenment is to struggle to not live. I want to live. I don't want to sit on the hilltop and sniff the flower all day. I don't want to sit with my garb on all day long in a secluded place, trying to reenact and to keep that moment of enlightenment going over and over and over by chanting or by whatever means that it might be, whether you're counting beads or whatever you might be doing to try to maintain or reestablish this moment of enlightenment. Enlightenment is something everyone in the Gospel Revolution has experienced, but the amazing thing is that we go back to living with a trajectory change. Lives forever changed in that moment, in that twinkling of an eye, if you will, and now we're able to see where we're going again. This is for trajectory change, not for something that you're supposed to experience all day long, every day. It's not where we're able to live, but it is vitally important that these moments are experienced. Mm-hmm.
And so it is that we must leave you, folks. But let us both say once again and a very big thank you to all of those gospel revolutionaries out there who make it possible to bring you this podcast each and every week. Ever wonder who they are? Here are their names. Albert Vitali from Gainesville, Georgia, and Anonymous from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Arthur Wirtz from Brandon, Manitoba. Look, this poor little Aussie boy's just guessing here. Manitoba, Canada. Billy Thompson from Huachuca City, Arizona. Bud and Ruth Ramsey from Park River, North Dakota. Deidre Simpson. I'm not doing bad, really, am I? Deidre Simpson from Kelowna, BC. British Columbia, Canada. Doug Bowman from Little Rock, Arkansas. Dwayne and Ruth Daku from Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, Canada. Elizabeth Ward from Munro, Washington. Harold Widmer from Edmonton, Alberta. Jackie Barnard from Manchester, Tennessee. G'day, Jackie. James and Gail Gustafson from Estevan, Saskatchewan, Canada. James Taylor from Calhoun, LA. What is LA? James, you know who you are, and you apparently are living in Calhoun, LA. Oh, you Americans are going to have such fun with me. Jerry and Suzman Berman from Longwood, Florida. John Van Sickle from Clyde, North Carolina. Kerry and Rita Waitman from Whitehall, MT. Cookie Davy Duck from Castor, Alberta. Linda Villander from Madison, Wisconsin. Michael Price from Gainesville, Georgia. Mike Cameliotis from Chandler, Arizona. Pep Washburn from Marshfield, Wisconsin. Robert Jones from Clarksville, Indiana. Robert Vacanti from Ottertail, Minnesota. Ted and Pat Winsett from Decatur, Alabama. Hey guys, how you doing down there? Tom and Linda Wilby from Fredericton, NB, Canada. Walter Wilson from Selma, Alabama. And Wolfgang and Helga Dykerhoff from Bluffton, Alberta, Canada. Whoa, got through it. These guys are our heroes, aren't they, Michael?
No doubt. It is. It really is amazing. We love doing this program for you, and we do it for ourselves, too. It's just a lot of fun to do. We appreciate involvement that you guys have been involved in so far. When it comes to the pledge drive, sometimes I just work myself into a linguistic corner. There's no way out. But thank you so much for what you've done. And we have some time left on the pledge drive. We're just actually in our finished our first week, I suppose. And we are doing well. But I don't think Jeff's getting any calls saying, please, please take my money. So make Jeff Robertson's day a whole lot brighter. Give him a call. Thank you guys so much for your participation. It does make our job so much easier when you do.
Family, if you'd like to join us in increasing our coverage of this gospel of grace and peace, call our office at area code 352-569-4889 and speak to Jeffrey, just the way Michael said. If you'd like to leave a message for the show, simply telephone us on 123-456-40971. Our web address is www.gospelrevolution.com, and you can catch us on Facebook at Friends of Mike Williams and the Gospel Revolution. Remember, no Christians were harmed in the making of this program, and for a quick fix not a day, our radio station is broadcasting all the gospel all the time at gospelrevolution.radiostream123.com. And so it's good night from myself, Beres Bartlett, at the highly chromed and superbly outfitted steam-driven Gospel Revolution Studios in Nashville, Tennessee, and from the very humble, almost pedestrian GRHQ in Houston, Texas.
It is good evening from Houston, Texas. Thank you, guys. We love you so very much. We look forward to next time. Hope you are, too.
So remember to join us again next week, same time, same channel, where we will do the same thing all over again.
Much better.
This week I had a really interesting chat with somebody, and I know Mike's just going to jump out of his skin when he hears this. Who have I got on the line there?
Mrs. Hazel Williams.
Like, as in Mrs. Michael Williams?
Yes.
How you doing, Hazel? Good to hear your voice.
Good to talk to you, too.
Hazel, where did you grow up?
In East Tennessee.
Same neck of the woods that Michael grew up in?
About 100 miles apart, yes.
Did you know each other as kids?
No.
Oh, okay. How old were you when you met?
I was 23 and he was 19.
Oh, really? You cradle snatcher.
Yeah.
So, 100 miles apart, how did you meet?
He came into town to run the youth center that we had there in town that our church was a part of, and they brought him in to be a part of that and brought him to our church for him to introduce him to the members of the church.
Now, you were a PK, weren't you? A preacher's kid.
Yes, I was.
How did that affect your upbringing?
Quite seriously. My dad was a Southern Baptist minister, and you were taught to go to church. If you weren't in church, you were a sinner, and you were going to go to hell if you didn't.
Was there much religious tension in the South back then? I'm thinking, say, Catholic, Pentecostals, Baptists.
Yeah, the Baptists didn't know how to handle the Catholics because of them. Well, I think part of it was ignorance because we didn't know that, you know, praying to Jesus or praying to the statues or praying to Mary. That's kind of all we knew about the Catholic Church. I don't think anybody ever researched their religion or their beliefs or anything. It was just that's the way we were taught, that they prayed to statues, so therefore, you know, Catholic wasn't right.
And back then, the Catholics were buried in the Catholic part of the cemetery, the Protestants were buried in the other part of the cemetery?
Yes.
Okay. So, Michael comes along. Did he fit into the cookie cutter of Christians as you knew them?
He kind of stood out because he was very charismatic. He had the ability to look at a total stranger and tell them that he loved them and meant it, and they knew that he meant it.
He's 6 foot six, too. I mean, that wouldn't have hurt, would it?
No. And he was tall, dark, and handsome, so that helped, too. So.
I am back.
I bet you scare little children with a voice like that.
I try.